This segment of King World News is sponsored by Esperanza Resources, an emerging gold and silver producer with two advanced stage projects and a $27 million cash position after selling a property to Silver Standard. And Esperanza Resources is one of the companies that Rick rules that would be taken over in the coming consolidation phase in the mining sector. Esperanza Resources, symbol EPZ in Canada and ESPZF in the U.S. This is King World News. I'm Eric King, and you're about to hear from the always popular Jim Rickards of Omnis. Remember to go to our homepage at kingworldnews.com, where this week we had some of the greats in the business. In addition to the previously mentioned Jim Rickards, we also had John Embry of Sprott Asset Management, the legendary Jim Sinclair, the former CEO of Goldcorp, Rob McEwen, and with gold and silver still consolidating, don't miss the KWN Weekly Metals Wrap. Joining us now is Jim Rickards. He is Senior Managing Director at Omnis. Mr. Rickards has been a direct participant in many of the most significant financial events over the past 30 years, including the 1981 release of U.S. hostages in Iran and the long-term capital management financial crisis of 1998, in which Mr. Rickards was the principal negotiator of the government-sponsored rescue. Jim, you've worked with the Fed, you've worked with the Treasury, you counsel the government directorates all over the world. I wanted to talk to you about QE today. A lot of commentators, including Jim Sinclair, have been saying that QE must continue past June because it's the only thing holding up the stock market and keeping the economy going right now. Yet the Fed has been signaling QE2 will end on schedule in June. What's your take on that? How do you reconcile somebody like Jim Sinclair, who's so brilliant, saying that it must continue, and yet we have the Fed trying to say, well, no, I don't think so?
Well, thanks, Eric. This actually is one of the great conundrums, to borrow a word from Alan Greenspan. And, you know, Jim Sinclair has been wrestling with it, and I've been wrestling with it, and a lot of other people have as well. But the bottom line is, you look at QE and what it's done to prop up stock market prices and kind of keep the economy going, you say, well, just logically, it's impossible to end it in June because the stock market would collapse, maybe with a lag, but maybe by the fall you'd see that collapse. And the economy would go into a real double dip. We're already seeing a double dip in housing. So logic and the state of the economy and the dynamics say they have to continue it. Yet the Fed has been signaling unmistakably that they will probably discontinue it. Now, the decision hasn't been made yet. The decision will be made at one of these upcoming meetings. But there are enough leaks and kind of winks and nods coming from Bernanke and Janet Yellen and Brian Sack and other officials indicating that they're going to end it. So I was wrestling with this thing. Well, gee, how can that be? And what's the answer? And then it finally struck me, based on a comment that Brian Sack made, for listeners who may not know, Brian Sack is the official at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York who actually conducts what they call open market operations. So when the Fed prints money or engages in QE or tries to reduce the money supply or tighten, whether they're easing or tightening, Brian Sack is the guy who actually does it. The Board of Governors and the Federal Open Market Committee in Washington make the decision. They instruct William Dudley, who's the president of the New York Fed, to go ahead and implement it, and then Dudley passes the order to Brian, and Brian's the guy who actually has his hand on the throttle, so to speak, and he actually conducts these operations. Well, he's been talking about stocks and flows, and that's some Fed jargon that may not be completely transparent to a lot of listeners, but the stock is the size of your balance sheet, and the flow is the incremental purchases under QE. And in my method of analysis, I've always focused on the flows. I think everything happens at the margin. It's the last purchase and the last sale that really kind of drives markets one way or the other. But then it occurred to me that the stock is now so large, the balance sheet is so large, that it actually becomes the flow. And what I mean by that is I think the Fed will stop QE in June. They will announce that they're going to stop it, you know, as of the end of June. But if they just keep the balance sheet where it is, the rollover, the existing securities, will be enough for them to monetize the debt. In other words, when you have almost $3 trillion of securities, there's a certain amount maturing every month. And when these Treasury notes mature, the Treasury just gives you the money. Well, when you get the money, what do you do with it? Well, you could keep it. In the case of the Fed, that would actually be reducing the money supply. But what the Fed's going to do is take that money from the maturing securities and go out and buy more securities. So at this point, they're so big that the additional buying, the so-called rollover, is big enough to keep QE going indefinitely, even if they don't expand the balance sheet. So that's how these two things reconcile. So I'm not calling it QE1, QE2, or QE3. I'm calling it perpetual QE. The Fed's balance sheet is now so big that it is a perpetual motion QE machine, and just rolling over the existing debt will be enough to monetize the deficit as far as the eye can see.
The King World News blog piece that you put out, Jim, Perpetual QE, the stock is the flow. Quote, QE has now become a permanent part of the financial landscape of the United States, end quote. It comes off to me then as very disingenuous for the Fed to say that this is ending on June 30th.
Well, again, it's a question of definitions. I agree with you, Eric. They're going to say, because their definition of QE is expanding the balance sheet. My point is they've expanded the balance sheet so far that they can keep QE going without expanding the balance sheet anymore, just using the reinvestment of the maturing proceeds. Let's just, for the listeners, let's just take them through some numbers so they can kind of see how this works. The first thing to remember is that the $600 billion of QE2 wasn't really $600 billion. It was $900 billion because under QE1, the Fed had purchased $1.5 trillion of mortgage-backed securities. Well, just think of the homeowner who pays her, you know, mortgage payment every month. There's a little bit of principal. It's principal and interest together, but there's some principal in there. Well, when you own $1.5 trillion of mortgages, you're getting principal payments all the time on the mortgages you hold. Well, what the Fed did is they took those and they reinvested it in new Treasury securities. So in addition to the $600 billion expansion, there was $300 billion of rollover from the old QE1. So QE2 was really $900 billion when you combine those two. Now where are we? Well, by the end of June, the Fed balance sheet is going to be up. They still have the $1.5 trillion or so of mortgage backs. That's declined somewhat because there are some prepayments there. But I estimate they're going to have about $1.6 trillion of Treasury notes and bonds on their balance sheet. So just taking the numbers that we already know, I think you can project $500 billion a year of principal payments on the mortgage-backed securities. So that's QE1. So the Fed's going to get $500 billion of new money every year just on those prepayments. Then go over to the $1.6 trillion of Treasury notes and bonds. They're going to get about $250 billion a year of principal payments on those. That's a little more difficult to estimate because the Fed's not completely transparent. But assuming that has a kind of an average weighted maturity of about 6 years and you own $1.6 trillion, that means, on average, $250 billion mature every year. So combining the $500 billion a year from QE1 and the $250 billion a year from QE2, and I'm talking about the principal payments that you receive, it gives the Fed $750 billion a year of new purchasing power, even if you don't expand the balance sheet. So the Fed's going to say to everyone, QE is over because we're not expanding the balance sheet. And I'm saying you don't have to. You can just take the $750 billion a year of principal payments on what you already own, reinvest those, and that's going to monetize two-thirds of the intermediate sector of the federal deficit. The deficit's coming in about $1.645 trillion for fiscal 2011. That's new deficit, by the way. That's not counting rolling over all the debt we already have. I'm leaving that off to one side. Of the $1.645 trillion, about 60% of that gets funded in the 2 to 10 year sector, 2 year notes to 10 year notes. So that comes to about $987 billion a year of kind of intermediate term debt. And the Fed's buying power is $750 billion per year just based on maturing stuff. So they're going to be able to monetize 75% of the deficit that's being funded in the intermediate sector, as far as the eye can see. So they can monetize the debt without expanding the balance sheet. That's how big they are today.
So, Jim, in the end, isn't the Fed lying when they say they're going to discontinue this on June 30th? I mean, it's a lie.
Well, you know, I hate to sound like Bill Clinton, but what's the definition of a lie? I mean, I think they are misleading the American people, and I think they're misleading the market. So I do agree with that. But on the other hand, they have talked about this, but it's kind of like what I've said about the IMF in the past. I've said the IMF is, I call it transparently non-transparent, meaning they put stuff out there and they tell you what they're doing, but it's so, unless you're an expert, it's very hard to kind of understand it and connect the dots. And most of the people who are experts are kind of working for the Fed or the IMF, so they're not kind of willing to explain what's going on. But there was a speech given by Brian Sack in December 2009 to what's called the Money Marketeers of New York University. It's kind of a funny name, Money Marketeers, but it's a very serious, well-respected group. And it was a long speech. And, you know, Brian is a PhD in economics from MIT. And in this, he explained this whole concept of stocks and flows, stock meaning the size of the balance sheet and flows meaning the incremental purchases. So it's all there. But, you know, you sort of hear stocks and flows, like, you know, what are you talking about? It sounds like an irrigation problem or something. In a way it is, because it's the flow of money. And Bernanke talked about it in his testimony before Congress last week. Janet Yellen said in an interview, we had a debate about stocks and flows, and the stocks won, meaning that tells me that they're not going to continue QE2, meaning they're not going to expand the size of the balance sheet. But when I look at it and I say, well, okay, well, what are the flows coming out of the stocks? The flows are so large that you can monetize the debt without increasing the stock. So it's really technical stuff, Eric. But if you're trying to defend the Fed, you can say, hey, look at our speeches, look at our interviews, look at our congressional testimony. We talked about this. My answer is, maybe you did, but you talked about it in a way that is not plain English. You talked about it in a way that's designed to mislead the markets. You're essentially lying to the American people.
Jim, let me ask you then. Let's go to the mechanics of this. How will this all work mechanically? Who are the players? What size purchases are we talking about here? Because, as I said, you've dealt with the Fed, the Treasury, so you're familiar with this type of action.
Yeah, I reckon that earlier in my career, I was chief credit officer at one of the primary dealers. And for listeners who don't know, a primary dealer is a special kind of bank that actually gets to deal directly with the Fed. When the Fed goes out and conducts what they call open market operations, that's the buying and selling of government securities to increase or decrease the money supply. Well, you think about any trade, you need someone to trade with. In other words, you can't trade with yourself. You need somebody on the other side. Well, the Fed has a list of approved banks, and these are the only ones that they will trade with. And that list are called the primary dealers. So I was, as I say, chief credit officer, one of the primary dealers, had many meetings with the Fed, met with the open market operations people. So I'm pretty familiar with how this all works. And it is done by the New York Fed. There are a number of regional Federal Reserve banks, but the New York Fed has always had a special role. And they carry out these operations on the instructions of the Federal Open Market Committee and the Board of Governors in Washington. The head of the open market desk, open market operations, is Brian Sack, whom we've mentioned. They've been fairly transparent about the maturity structure. They've actually published a schedule with dates and quantities and a range of maturities, and they tell you what they're going to buy. And then the primary dealers kind of go out and find those bonds, and they're kind of all lined up. And it's like eBay, you tell people what you want to sell or buy, and people can kind of respond accordingly. So that operation goes fairly smoothly. What's difficult is kind of understanding what's really going on in terms of the macroeconomy and the overall size of the Fed's balance sheet. That's a lot more opaque. By the way, this is the first time that the balance sheet has ever been anything like this relative to the size of the market and relative to the size of the economy. This business of rolling over maturing debt, I mean, the Fed does that all the time. The Fed has always done that, but they were much smaller. When you're $800 billion, right, and you're rolling over maturing debt, that's one thing. But when you're $3 trillion, and you're rolling over maturing debt, that is a much larger market impact. So the process of rolling over maturing debt is old news. But because of the sheer size of it, they now just dominate the market. I've compared it to the figure of Leviathan in Thomas Hobbes' philosophical work of the 17th century. The Fed is now the Leviathan of the bond market and dominates everything in its sight.
This is critical that professionals, investors, and other listeners around the world understand this concept, Jim, because the Fed will use this with their other operations to go after the, you know, the currency markets, the gold markets, the silver markets, the commodity markets. And really, in the end, it's a smokescreen, is what you're saying.
Well, it's a smokescreen. If the Fed comes out and says that they're going to end QE in June, if they say that, but don't explain to people that what's really going on is that we have QE in perpetuity, we have QE forever. Because they're so big that just the rollover is enough to buy all the debt and monetize the debt. If they don't explain it that way, then I think they're being completely misleading. And just a word on the timing of this, Eric. QE2 right now is scheduled to end at the end of June. There are only three open market committee meetings between now and then. One is next week, March 15th. There's another one on April 26th. There's no meeting in May, and then there's a meeting in June 21st. Well, they're not going to wait till June 21st to make a decision. They might wait until June 21st to officially announce it, right? But they're going to make the decision before that because they have to signal the marketplace. They don't want the market, you know, with kind of 5 days to go or a week to go in QE2, wondering, gee, what the heck are you guys doing, right? Because they don't want to shock the market. They want to signal so that the market can adjust, and it's a very smooth adjustment. So, as I said, there might be an official announcement in June, but they're going to make this decision. They have to make it either in March or April. Those are the only other meetings that they're going to have. My estimate is that they will make the decision in March. In other words, they'll make the decision next week. They will not announce it in so many words. They will signal it. You know, they'll all go out and give speeches, and they'll go on TV, and they'll kind of, with a wink and a nod, say, you know, with QE2, it's going to be over in June. But what they're not going to say is that it's never over because the rollover of the existing portfolio is so big that they've got $750 billion a year of buying power even without expanding the balance sheet. That's the point.
Jim, I don't know when, but at some point, this is going to be used in the media to try to attack gold, attack silver, and smash those metals down. But it is disingenuous. It's not really real. It's more like a smokescreen, as you said. And maybe the attack will begin from higher levels. But I don't imagine countries like China will fall for this. They know better. They're just going to continue, I would imagine, buying all the dips and trading in fiat for real money.
Sure, the Chinese won't fall for it. They are extremely smart. They're very analytical. They've got, you know, just teams of people who are all over this stuff, and they're probably listening to your show. They will totally get it. But you're right. I do worry a little bit about the kind of the typical investor or the person who's not, you know, as immersed in this as you and I are discussing, and they hear that QE2 is over, because that will be the sort of public face of this. And the conclusion is, okay, well, QE2 is over. The Fed is pulling in its horns. The inflation scare will go away. They want to talk down oil, talk down gold, talk down silver, and kind of get all these markets to walk back a little bit over this announcement effect of the end of QE2. But, of course, the reality is that QE2 is, as I mentioned, is now permanent. They're going to be continuing to monetize the debt. I estimate at the rate of $750 billion a year, which is huge. It's 50% of the total debt, and it's, you know, about 75% of the portion in the intermediate sector. By the way, Eric, the Treasury has no problem selling Treasury bills. They can sell Treasury bills all day long. They don't need the Fed to prop up the bill market. These are kind of 30-day instruments, 60-day instruments, you know, anything up to 1 year. The Treasury has no problem selling those. There's actually a bid for 30-year bonds because it's got a really long duration, and insurance companies have always liked those for their portfolios. The place where it gets tricky, where you have to prop up the market, is in the kind of the 2 to 10 year sector. And that's what we're talking about. So even though the rollover, what I call QE to perpetuity, may only be 50% of the deficit, but it's 75% of the intermediate sector. So there's a strong bid in that sector, even without expanding the balance sheet. So for people looking at, you know, precious metals and commodities and hard assets, don't be fooled by the end of QE, because there is no end of QE. QE is going to go on in perpetuity until the Fed decides to tighten. And I don't see that before, you know, kind of 2012 at the earliest.
Jim, I know this is awful. You and I wouldn't want this job. But if you look at what these guys are doing, basically what you're saying is they're trying to inflate away this debt, but they really don't want to have panic of money globally flowing into these commodities the way we're seeing into gold, into silver. They're trying to halt that. So it's disingenuous. It's outright lying, and it's deceitful. But we understand what they're doing.
Sure. The Fed has to inflate away the deficit. That's very clear. They have to devalue the dollar and foreign exchange markets. That's what the currency wars are all about. So they have to do these things. But here's the thing. They want it to be what they call orderly. Again, the Fed always has these buzzwords, and there's the difference between orderly and disorderly. They want orderly inflation, but they don't want disorderly inflation. They want an orderly collapse of the dollar, but they don't want a disorderly collapse of the dollar. So it's all finesse, and a lot of it is propaganda and deceiving people, as we've described. And so this is a perfect example where you say, okay, QE2 is over. So that kind of takes a little bit of the inflation juice out of the market, at least psychologically, but don't underestimate the importance of psychology. Very important to velocity and other drivers of this. So they get the benefit of the sort of the good headline, right? But the reality is quite different. The reality is they got $750 billion of buying power, so there's still a strong bid under the market, and they can still, in effect, monetize the debt just with the rollover. So this is the kind of finesse that they do, but I don't know what to say. If I had the job, it'd be a lot more honest with the American people.
Jim, on a separate note, here we have the government doing this program right now where they're essentially carrying on QE, but they're saying they're not. At the same time, and this may not have been orchestrated, as you know, but we have another Fed official who called Ron Paul a pinhead in one of his pieces. And that's a bit outrageous, but it's almost like, let's say we're discontinuing QE. Let's start attacking Ron Paul and the gold bugs. I mean, is this set up for a fight? And what were your thoughts when you saw that?
Yeah, Eric, this one really, really outraged me. You know, I kind of, as an analyst, I kind of pride myself on stick to the numbers, stick to the analysis, you know, just be very kind of level-headed about it. Some of these things may be personally outrageous, but I try not to kind of get too wound up about them. But this one really, really aggravated me. Just to kind of give the listeners the background, this comes from David Andolfato. David Andolfato is a vice president of the St. Louis Fed. So he's a government official, a senior official of the Federal Reserve System. He, of course, has a PhD in economics, so that probably explains a lot. But he, in an interview, he called Ron Paul a pinhead and said that his ideas were stupid. So he's not disagreeing with him. He's actually insulting him. Now, we all know who Ron Paul is, but he's not just a prominent spokesman and senior member of Congress. Ron Paul is the chairman of the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Domestic Monetary Policy. That means Ron Paul is the chairman of the subcommittee that oversees the Fed's monetary policy. So here we have an official of the Fed referring to the chairman of the congressional committee that supervises him as a pinhead and a stupid. So what strikes me about this, and I'll tell you in a second why Ambafato is completely wrong, by the way, but the point is, here you have the unelected official humiliating the elected official, right? Because Ron Paul has to run for election. Ron Paul has to get people in his district to vote for him. He's the sort of avatar of the democratic process and what America is all about. David Ambafato is an unelected gnome sitting in St. Louis working for the Fed. So how did America get to the point where the unelected officials are completely relaxed about referring to our elected officials as pinheads? Because that's where we are today. So just to come back on this a little bit, Ron Paul is right and Ambafato is wrong. Let me explain why. The particular issue is Ron Paul has made the point in his book and in speeches, and I've made the same point, that the Fed has devalued the dollar by 95%, actually slightly more, since its creation. It was created in 1913. If you took a dollar in 1913 and say, what is it worth today? The answer is less than a nickel. If you're holding four pennies in your hand, that's about what your dollar is worth. And by the way, the Fed's number one job is price stability, so nice going, guys. Nice job with your mandate. You know, if I were a money manager, Eric, which I am, if you gave me money and I lost 95% of your money and I came back to you and said, Eric, sorry, I lost 95% of your money, you know, you'd probably hang me, sue me, you know, who knows what else you would do, and you'd be properly outraged. The Fed has destroyed the value of our money by 95%, but somehow we're supposed to keep listening to them. So Ron Paul's right about that. What Ambafato said was, well, okay, maybe you've destroyed the value by 95%, but they have a theory, because there's always a theory, right? Their theory is money neutrality, which is that money relative to goods and services doesn't really change that much. And they said, well, the value may have gone down, but your wages have gone up by a factor of 20. So your money's worth less, but your wages have gone up by the same amount. So it all comes out in the wash. And that's what they call money neutrality. Here's the problem with money neutrality. It may be somewhat true in the aggregate, but it is not true at all in the micro. When you destroy currencies, when you destroy the value of the dollar, there are winners and losers. And the winners are the people who understand the process, buy gold, buy silver, buy hard assets, hedge their positions, get out of the way, or find other ways of kind of looting the system, kind of to take wealth from others, which is what they do on Wall Street. The losers are the average Americans, the people who are saving their money, counting on their retirement, looking at their Social Security, living on fixed incomes, living on annuities. They're the people who can't get out of the way of this moving train. And so it maybe in the aggregate, there's something to the money neutrality idea. But in reality, when you get to the micro level, it's theft. It's theft by the elites from the poor. It's theft of the bankers from the average Americans. That's what's going on. So the leads and the lags, the timing differences, the inequalities, the whole idea of winners and losers, that's the problem with what Ambafato is advocating here. So Ron Paul is exactly right. It's a moral issue. It's an ethical issue. But it's also an economic issue. It's bad enough that he is so arrogant to call Ron Paul a pinhead. But it's worse than that because he's wrong.
Jim, we will have your King World News blog piece, Perpetual QE, the stock is the flow, link directly from your interview page. I would encourage all the listeners globally to go read that. For the listeners also, can you tell them how to follow you on Twitter?
Sure, Eric. Thanks. I have a very active Twitter feed. It's James G. Rickards. Rickards is R-I-C-K-A-R-D-S. I know you usually put a link on the King World News website. So I invite anyone who's interested to follow me on Twitter. I put out a steady kind of feed of, you know, analysis, the kind of thing we talk about in your program, and I love people to follow along if they like.
Jim Rickards, Senior Managing Director at Omnis. Thank you for joining us on King World News.
Thank you, Eric.
Be sure to tune in this week as we will continue to release interviews with the top people in the world throughout the week. Also, check out the King World News blog, where this past week we had interviews with some of the greats in the business, such as Jim Sinclair, Rob McEwen, John Embry, John Hathaway, James Turk, Luis Yamada, as well as pieces from Jim Rickards, Richard Russell, and something new from Pharos Trading.